Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, it's my pleasure to have as my guest Joan Didion, whose most recent collection of essays from Knopf is titled Political Fictions. As I was reading, well, actually rereading, since most of these essays were in the New York Review of Books, as I was rereading the essays in Political Fictions and some of the earlier novels, I came to see that Joan Didion, both in her essays and in her novels, has been effectively examining the same problem, which is that when you create a narrative, you create expectations of stories that take over, that the details are what is preferable, in a sense, to story. And it's only by almost parsing the details out of a story that one can return to a sense of truth.
Return to a sense of the actual thing that's going on, because we superimpose a story on what we see. I mean, it's very hard. When you think of a dream you had, you always remember a story that's much stronger than the dream itself. Well, I think a lot of what we experience, we superimpose a story on.
I found myself describing yesterday the most recent novel, The Last Thing He Wanted, by my guest Joan Didion, as being in the process not of losing a needle in a haystack or of looking for a needle in a haystack, but the miracle of finding a needle in a haystack. By the time you really are understanding the book's working, you're aware that you have to handle that book with jeweler's calipers, that the pieces have become so small, and that the more you read it, the narrower the microseconds of chronology become, and the more you come to understand has been simultaneous in it. And it seems like the analysis is very similar to the way these essays are built, almost as if what happens is that the research is gathered, placed side by side, and when you see enough things said by enough reporters, you know those are the lies, and that those are the things that need to be
to be opened up.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, what would you say the the narrative of the most recent election is at its most basic?
Well, I would say it was about how the political process has been tending, at least over the past 12 years, toward disenfranchising America, toward disenfranchising the actual electorate. That was kind of what I came to. Every time I did one of these pieces, I would come to that conclusion, but it would take me laboriously, once again, because I was always coming at it from a different angle, to find the path, and then I would find that it led to this same place.
Now, I've been thinking about, as I think is inevitable, the recent hijackings, and wondering if the immediate rush to create these events as part of a holy war of sorts, a religious war, is part of the narrative you're talking about.
I think there are a lot of narratives that we've seen in play since that. We've heard a lot about, we did it before and we can do it again, and Pearl Harbor, et cetera. There is, over the past several years, there has grown up a kind of popular romance about World War II, and that generation, and we're seeing. I've actually heard people say on television, kids say on television, now we have our chance. Well, you know, I don't know what exactly they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have told themselves a story about a moment of glory that is going to come.
Well, in the final essay in After Henry, the story about the rape of the jogger in Central Park,
mm-hmm.
you make a distinction between the narrative of the problem of the city is crime and the actual narrative, which is that the problems of New York City are based on a series of easements and...
It's based on greed, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Manipulations
mm-hmm.
that make a popular narrative, like a rape at night mm-hmm. by a jogger, a suitable replacement
mm-hmm.
for the populace.
It's a fairy tale that covers the actual.
And it seems to me that here, too, this desire immediately to move away from the political situation to the idea of a holy war and a people who can't be...
Or a crusade on our part, yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think that word was used, I think.
Well, I think we'll be hearing it more
mm-hmm.
and more. Has it always been, do you think, or at least as long as you've been analyzing the case, that there is the space between the popular story and the...
I think it has been there. I think that in some ways, the political class has gotten better at it. Polling, everything has gotten much more refined in the past dozen years, and you can really cut. Bits of gathered information a million different ways in a microsecond because of technology, which makes the whole thing kind of faster, you know, makes the whole thing move faster and more. It has a momentum of its own now. I mean, I don't know that it's going to stop unless a whole lot of people stand up and say, stop.
I thought that the effort of the political class is to conceal the details in the popular story, but the effort of the novelist and the essayist is to return actualities to the reader so that they can be, if not reprocessed, at least the insistence with which they've been soldered into
right.
resolution can be dismantled
mm-hmm.
again.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that in the introduction to Political Fictions, there's a set of notes that you took on the process of going to the first primary. I believe it was Jesse Jackson's.
Right.
And that event of being at first told that you're in the wrong place and going to a succession of wrong and righter places appears in the novel more or less.
You're right.
Verbatim.
Yes, it does. In the last thing he wanted, yeah.
And so I wondered what the relation between the notes that go for fiction and the notes that go for nonfiction.
Well, you see, when I wrote about the 88 campaign, I had a whole set of notes that I made when I was doing the research. I had, you know, 60 to 80 pages of single space notes, which I just typed as I went along. And then I used very little of it. When I was doing the last thing he wanted, it just struck me that particular moment was something so humiliating in a way that it would reveal something. To put Elena in that moment would reveal something about her.
But do you have a sense of a different? Because I'm beginning
it's not
to
a different
sense.
Process.
Yes,
yeah.
That's what I think. That it's
yeah.
not a different process,
no.
and that its goals are the same too.
Right.
Only it's very hard for a novelist to simultaneously construct a story and reveal its counter story. Life does that for you in the essays.
Yeah. Yeah.
The novelist has to, in a sense, be writing two books.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, you are. As an, I mean, it's kind of. I mean, it's a very, it's a very. I can't explain what is different about writing a novel, but that's probably as close. You're nothing is quite as straightforward because well, there's a reason why. I always read The Good Soldier before I start. The reason is it has an unreliable narrator. Well, we're all unreliable narrators. I mean, even those of us who are telling a straight story.
Well, it seems to have moved further in these last two books, not unreliable narrators, but unreliable narrative. Narrative
yeah.
itself.
Yeah, is deceptive. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me to be the most recent development, in a sense, not only in the political scene, but in fiction as well, that it would be almost old-fashioned now to create a narrative structured around one liar when it seems as if the culture structures stories so that will you, nil you, mm-hmm. you are telling a lie unless you've set yourself the goal of not doing so, and even then.
Mm-hmm. Even then, Who can know the last thing you wanted has, while it is about the on one level it is about the unreliability of narrative, it actually has probably the strongest narrative I ever wrote, I mean, the most straight line.
Eventually, once it's placed together. But,
yeah.
you know, what you once said in an interview, that the last sentence of a story should, if it's working, make you want to read,
read
it again.
Read it again, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That worked three times for me. And the last thing he wanted. And the last thing I wanted was to enter that world again, and yet I do it like someone walking through a revolving door over and over again.
When I was in San Francisco, I walked over to Grace Cathedral, and there were people walking. There's a labyrinth there, you know? And there were people walking it, and that was what that novel was. It was like walking a labyrinth.
Now, you once also said in that very bright interview with Linda Kuehl, who I like, you know, it seems to me, she asks good questions.
She's dead now.
Yes.
Yeah.
That writing a novel is a hostile act. And it seems to me that these essays are as well. And part of the hostility is creating a book that I had to go through, wanted to go through three times in order to completely inhabit its intricacies. So that I feel as if, as I read the essays, I, who have perhaps a radio's announcer's tendency to general statements, my sentences become demystified. There are so many words and quotes that I want to swear I'll never use again.
Okay.
I'll never be guilty of that solecism. The work seems to make the reader, who gives way to it, more and more self-conscious about what lying is. And it seems to be designed to do that, to purify the person who's willing to surrender to the novel's hostility.
Well, it's kind of a sermon, you know. It's very didactic.
In what way?
I think it's an exhortation. It's saying, look at this, take it apart. Look, what are they really saying? You know, I mean, it's I don't mean read. Everybody reads. Well, they don't read. A lot of people, though, seem to have stopped reading critically.
Well, it starts from the very beginning. You say that friends and people who knew you would begin by saying, "Gee, Joan, I didn't know that you were a politics junkie."
Mm-hmm.
And that even hearing that repeatedly caused you to realize they actually think the only people interested in politics
are the professionals.
Yes.
Yeah. That no one else, that it's not legible to anyone outside and shouldn't be. That it's correctly understood only by its professionals.
And then given the metaphor that if you are a junkie, you're already addicted enough to want more of things as they are.
Yes.
So the process seems like having to put on a set of ears so finely tuned that anything said reveals the hidden sequestering of political culture into a private sector where the people who participate are in fact surprised,
mm-hmm.
or even bothered by an interest from a common citizen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Their idea of a common of a response from a citizen is you know an email that has been sent to them because one or another interest group has urged its members to send an email to their congressman, and that is an acceptable to people in the political class, that is an acceptable contact with the electorate.
And better an email that's been pre-written that they only have to address.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, if it has reached the point that, as you suggest, the reporters are part of the story that they're telling, that they've acquiesced to it, that they don't report, that they've brought in a camel to pose with Bush in the Middle East,
the LA Times did report that, in fact.
And that events that take place in urban schools are not taking place in low-income districts. Mm-hmm. The whole process of misrepresentation mm-hmm. now includes the press.
They are present and they know what the situation actually is, but they don't actually write it down very much of the time.
Right. So where what
they don't write it down. There are a couple of reasons they don't. One is the harsher reason is that they would lose access, and if they lose access, they can't cover the beat. Right. So that's one reason, but the other reason is that they come into reporting with an idea that to form any kind of opinion is biased, shows bias, that it's not fair or impartial. When in fact all it is required to be impartial is to come into the situation with an open mind, with an impartial mind. There is nothing in the journalistic code that prevents you from actually noticing that somebody is saying the exact opposite of what he or she said yesterday and maybe making a comment on that, or that somebody is doing an event that's meant for the camera. But there seems to be an aversion to rendering judgment.
Now, given this, is there any way out or is it all labyrinth?
Well, you know, I think I always think there is some way out. I always think there is going to be some kind of wake-up call. People, and I think that if enough people notice, enough people say that's not what you said yesterday, why is that camel in the shot? Maybe we can get past this. There ought to be a way of talking directly. I mean, some people have talked directly to the electorate. I know someone who had run for office and been a senator and had run for president told me once that when he went off message, as they say, when he said what was really on his mind, that his handlers were desperately upset, you know, and in fact, it seemed to confuse everyone in the around him, and so he went back on mess. You know, it's just not really done at the moment, but it certainly could be.
It seems as if in your most recent books, as opposed to the kind of anomie and passivity that they used to write about in your characters, that something else has taken its place. The characters, as I read an essay of yours, it's as if I become a character in a Joan Didion book. And it's as if the information given me first makes me feel helpless, but then makes me feel angry. And that's the beginning of the break in passivity. And it seems as if what's happened in the work is that the corrective to anomie is a more and more precise analytic mind, that what it discovers, that mind, may be so disturbing that at first immobility might be a response, but that the corrective to immobility, too, is further research.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Has that helped you as a writer?
Yeah, it has. I trust, you know, you always doubt that you're going to be able to finish anything, but I have more trust that if I stay with it, it's going to go somewhere, which I didn't really used to have. It's a whole different process than the way I used to write. A lot of it came when I started using a computer, because the DOS was so unforgiving, and so you were in the wrong if it wasn't, people were always telling me when I was in high school that if I would really stop failing geometry, that geometry would give me logic, right? But geometry never did give me logic, because I could always find another way to solve the problem that wasn't the correct way, right? But there's no way you can solve DOS except its way. Everything about it was logical, which actually affected the way I thought in an odd way.
I wondered, too, because if you compare, say, The White Album with political fictions, there's a steelier, finer, it seems to me, mind at work, but the people being considered by that mind have also removed themselves from the kind of hysteria that was being looked at in The White Album. This seems to me, of course, to be a change in time, but it also seemed to be the result almost of something cultural as well. These people in political fictions don't seem as frightened as the people in The White Album, perhaps the cause of psychoactive drugs. And I began to think, has this bleaching of hysteria, since the drugs take care of that,
well,
of panic.
I think that the people I'm looking at in political fictions are public people. So you're looking at their public faces to the world. They know how to do that. They know how to pull their face together most of the time. You know, I mean, there was always once in a while somebody fascinating who doesn't know how to pull his face together. But most of the time they do. The people I was looking at in the White Album were private people, by and large, or accidentally public people.
But I think of all these handlers, for instance, and their snap judgments and their knowing what they want, what's necessary, and not being confused by an appeal to pity or honesty. They know what being on point means. Mm. And while something else may be more interesting, some more human statement. And it seemed to me as if, oh my, these people go home to their pills.
maybe so.
I'm curious if you will say what you're working on now.
Have been messing around with something. I'm not sure it'll work or not. It's a sort of extended reflection about California. As an idea, but I'm not sure where it's going. I would really like to finish it by the spring, but I'm not sure that I will, or finish it at all. You know.
I have been speaking to Joan Didion, a novelist and essayist, and now political essayist. Whose work, oddly, in the light of this book, traces, both in novel and essay form, the distinction between the public story and the private story. And her strength has always been the isolation of personal details that reveal character even while the character is immersed in telling the public story. And so it's really thrilling to come to the last two books, The Last Thing He Wanted and Political Fictions, recently published by Knopf, and see side by side in fiction and essay such a demystified and very profound and subtle vision coming to its apex. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. You can read the foreword to Political Fictions on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse. Pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.